This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Sometimes you just can't help speculating a bit. Have we reached peak inflation yet? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Washington, D.C., I'm Kimberly Adams in for Kai Rizdal. It's Tuesday, August 9th. Good to have you with us. With the House set to take up the Inflation Reduction Act this week, it's a good time to talk about inflation as a measure. Maybe hard to imagine, but until recently, the release of the Consumer Price Index was kind of a snoozer for most people. Now, though, it feels like the whole economy waits with bated breath for the CPI. And the next release is tomorrow morning. Marketplace's Matt Levin gets us going.
So just to jog your memory, the headline inflation rate, that's the rate that includes volatile gas and food prices and will be making actual headlines tomorrow. Anyway, that rate in June was 9.1%, which is not good.
That was the most worried I've been about inflation.
Betsy Stevenson is an economist at the University of Michigan. She's particularly troubled by the consistent rise in service prices, and we'll be looking for that tomorrow.
So medical services, childcare services, haircuts, it indicates inflation that might be not likely to fix itself.
And harder for the Fed to fix with rate hikes. But there may be bright spots in tomorrow's numbers. Gas prices dipped in July and some commodities got cheaper. And there are indications that the cost of goods is dropping, at least online, says Vivek Pandia, who tracks e-commerce for Adobe.
We're now starting to see prices for major categories like electronics and apparel start to come down. And that deflation is, you know, a first for us in quite some time.
Pandia says retailers are discounting all that excess patio furniture and other pandemic inventory stuck in their warehouses. But even if tomorrow's CPI numbers are better than expected, we can't assume inflation has finally been whipped. Greg McBride is chief financial analyst with Bankrate.com.
We've been head faked three or four times in the last year or so on inflation and the idea of whether or not it has peaked.
As for the number of times we say the word inflation on this program, yeah, that may not have peaked either. I'm Matt Levin for Marketplace.
And here's another one. The inflation in home prices over the past few years has a pretty simple explanation. Too much demand, not enough supply. But that may be changing. According to new data from Realtor.com, there were 30% more homes for sale in July of this year than there were the same time last year. That's the highest year-over-year increase in inventory since the site started tracking the number in 2017. Marketplace's Samantha Fields reports on what that means for anyone thinking of buying or selling a home right now.
There haven't been nearly enough homes for sale to meet demand for years now. Allie Wolf at the housing data and consultancy firm Zonda says that was true even before the pandemic.
And when the pandemic hit and there was this extra level of demand, we saw inventory levels hit new lows.
Now, she says, that is finally starting to change.
For the past couple of months now, we've seen inventory on both the new and on the resale side rise.
To be clear, there still aren't that many homes for sale, just more than there were a year ago. Danielle Hale at Realtor.com says the main reason for the rise in inventory is that mortgage rates are up and home prices are still near record highs.
That combination means that today's home shoppers are looking at a monthly mortgage payment that's up about 50% compared to a year ago.
So fewer people are actively looking to buy right now. And those who are being pickier, says Daryl Fairweather at real estate brokerage website Redfin.
What's happening is that the homes that are being listed aren't attracting offers right away. And so they're sitting and piling up on the market, and that's adding to more inventory.
Redfin's data shows the percentage of homes sitting on the market for more than 30 days is up too. And more sellers have been cutting their prices.
I've been telling sellers to price modestly so that your home sells quickly and you don't end up with homes sitting on the market.
But Fairweather says not everyone is ready to do that.
They may have seen that their neighbor's home sold for a certain amount, and anything less than that price would be a loss in their mind. And it's hard to get people past that mindset.
But she says for sellers, it's worth remembering that even though the market may be cooling a bit, home prices are still much higher than they were a year ago. So they're still going to make a lot of money. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, just waiting on that inflation report. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The pandemic, in addition to upending the economy, put a lot of big projects on hold. For example, the National Institutes of Health was trying to create the most diverse health data bank in the world, including DNA and medical records. But the pandemic paused in-person recruiting of a million participants. Now, the so-called All of Us project has relaunched its bus tour. Blake Farmer of WPLN caught a stop in Nashville.
Americans of European descent make up the vast majority of participants in clinical trials. And that's meant modern medicine has missed some things, like the recent revelation that pulse oximeters don't work so well on darker skin. This diverse data bank is meant to provide big data crunching potential and supply participants for clinical trials. Taxpayers have already committed more than $1 billion through the NIH, but it requires something scientists don't do enough of, getting out of the lab. Mae Sandberg is the outreach manager for the All of Us project. She's seeking shade under a tent on a hot summer day. They're set up in the parking lot of an international mall here on the south side of Nashville. It's called Plaza Mariachi. She's helping Maritza Castro, originally from Nicaragua, who walks up to the tents after hearing about the project on Spanish language media. Castro says she's ready to board the bus and offer samples of her blood and urine, along with electronic medical records, despite being a little fearful of how her own health information and genetic material will be used.
Well, yeah, of course I'm afraid, but I know that this is good for other people. It might be a personal inconvenience, but I'm here in this country.
That's Sandberg translating. Castro says she's also interested in the report participants can get on their own genetic risks. She joins more than 350,000 participants across the U.S. who've granted access to medical records, submitted body measurements, and donated at least one biospecimen. Nearly 17% self-identify as Hispanic or Latino, roughly aligning with the U.S. population. Organizers say the data, managed by Vanderbilt University, is extremely secure, though breaches are always a risk, and the scientists who apply to use the data must be vetted. While improving the diversity of research is the goal, Sandberg says informed consent from the participants is a must.
That's why it takes some time, because we want to make sure that people are aware what they're sharing, and they can say yes or no.
And Zoom events just don't cut it when you're asking people from marginalized communities to share every bit of data that exists about their health and humanity, especially given the history in some communities of exploitive research. Edgar Gilrico of the National Alliance for Hispanic Health has been helping identify locations like this one at Plaza Mariachi.
We have to make those cultural connections. Like, I get here and somebody hears my accent. They're like, oh, you're from Colombia. I'm also from Colombia. And then we end up talking about, like, why we're here, how we got here. And then that's how the culture works in our environment. So being in person for us is key.
Through the pandemic, up until a few months ago, the outreach was entirely virtual. Participants can fill out the extensive surveys online and even offer their DNA samples through private lab companies. But that kind of reliance on technology risks attracting the usual clinical trial participants. Beyond racial and ethnic diversity, this project targets anyone underrepresented in bioresearch, which includes seniors.
There are some barriers that older adults might face around digital divide.
Gretchen Funk is with 50 Ford, one of the 100 nonprofits partnering with the NIH. She says when the concept is fully explained face-to-face, seniors are receptive.
They want to leave a legacy. They want to consolidate their experiences over their lifetime and leave something for the future generation. So this program really aligns with that.
Seniors seem to be responding. So far, roughly 40% of participants are over age 60, and the data bank has already yielded some valuable research. It found COVID was in the U.S. weeks before the first reported cases because some of the blood samples already had antibodies. In Nashville, I'm Blake Farmer for Marketplace.
There has been intense weather all over the country this summer, with extreme heat, drought, rain, and floods causing death and damage in places struggling to adjust to our new climate reality. Flooding in June around Yellowstone National Park forced the iconic wilderness area to close and later limit public entrance at several gates. Mountain West News Bureau reporter Madeline Beck talked with people in two communities about what the closures mean for them, starting with West Yellowstone.
Utah resident Nicole Willoughby was visiting Yellowstone with relatives from Missouri and California. But when they arrived in West Yellowstone, they found out that the park was only allowing cars with license plates ending in odd numbers to enter on odd days. They got lucky enough to get into the park, even if a big part of it was still closed when they stopped by.
Luckily, my license plate ends in a 7, so I could go yesterday.
Were you guys planning this trip for a long time?
I think since like January, so it was kind of a bummer, but it's okay.
That was in late June. Park officials have since reopened northern sections of the park and ended the odd-even license plate system. But business owners told me how much the park means to West Yellowstone, Montana, and how even a short closure or reduction in visitors affects those around town. Bob Jacklin owns Jacklin's Fly Shop there. He's been a fishing guide around West Yellowstone for more than 50 years.
The park means everything to this town, like the other community towns. So the minute the park opens, we're open. The minute it closes, we're closed. That's how it works.
While the flooding closures were unprecedented, Jacklin says West Yellowstone itself didn't face much flooding, just regular high water. At the same time, hotels had significant cancellations. For example, Three Bear Lodge reported having about 30 or 40% of its usual occupancy when the park was closed. Still, folks in West Yellowstone say others had it much worse, like those in Red Lodge, Cook City, and Gardner, Montana, where flooding and park closures were far more severe. Gardner now has an access road into the park, but it's only open to tour guides like Brad Boleyn.
I mean, this is actually one of the cheapest ways to get in the park with a tour guide right now is come to Gardner, and one of the cheapest places to stay.
That's because of limited park access and services. Boleyn and his wife Carolyn own Yellowstone Wildlife Profiles. As of late July, even the guides could only come and go from Yellowstone at certain times of day. That's so the park can shore up the road guides are using. Brad and Carolyn say it's an 1800 stagecoach path that's being turned into a new 2-lane paved access road since the main road was destroyed by flooding.
We have very short windows when we can actually drive on it because when people are driving on it, they can't work on it.
The Boleyn's business is coming back a little, but not as much as they'd like. Carolyn is pregnant, due in September. Their other child is almost 2. They just started this tour business last year after they were laid off during the pandemic. She says other businesses in town are struggling even more. Some even burned down in a fire in 2020. It's been a tough few years in Gardner. Carolyn says she worries about what the economic fallout will mean for local family-owned businesses.
And there already aren't very many kids here because it's hard to raise a family here. It's expensive. So that, if you know, has long-term effects on the school and the school's funding and just what it's like to try to raise a family here.
Another business owner, Jeremy Backer, has two young daughters in Gardner and operates the Grizzly Grill. He says last year around this time, he was making around $2,000 a day. More recently, it was $200 a day. He had to lay off staff, but keeps working alone to provide for his family and get federal aid.
If I am applying for grants or any kind of help from the government, they need to see working capita.
Backer says some businesses will stay closed for the summer if they can afford to. Others may never reopen. Both Backer and the Boleyns say they hope people realize that towns like Gardner are open for business, even if there are limitations. For many in town, the floods and fallout were even more devastating because they thought this would finally be the year Gardner got back on its feet. In Boise, Idaho, I'm Madeline Beck for Marketplace.
Coming up.
This is from our homecoming, where the campus queens would be in the homecoming parade.
Memories worth preserving. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 58 points, a tenth of a percent, to close at 32,774. The Nasdaq lost 150 points, one and a tenth percent, to finish at 12,493. The S&P 500 shed 17 points, four tenths of a percent, to end at 4,122. President Joe Biden signed the CHIPS and Science Act into law today. With grants and credits from the act, chipmaker Micron Technology announced it would invest $40 billion in the U.S. over the next 8 years. Qualcomm said it would increase domestic chip production by 50% over the next 5 years. Both chip makers had down days on the markets, though. Micron gave back 3.75%. Qualcomm slowed 3.5%. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.78%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
And now a word from our sponsors at Betterment. Do you want your money to dream big? Do you want your money to be a total self-starter? Are you annoyed that your money doesn't work hard enough? Don't worry. Betterment is here to help. Betterment is the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Their automated technology is built to help maximize returns, meaning when you invest with Betterment, your money can auto-adjust as you get closer to your goal, rebalance if your portfolio gets too far out of line, and your dividends are automatically reinvested. That can increase the potential for compound returns. In other words, your money is breaking a sweat while you can be breaking bread. You'll never picture your money the same way again. Betterment, the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Visit Betterment.com to get started. Investing involves risk. Performance is not guaranteed.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kimberly Adams. Advanced computer programs influence and can dictate meaningful parts of our lives. Streaming services, credit scores, facial recognition software. And as this technology becomes more sophisticated and more pervasive, it's useful to understand some basic terminology. People often use the terms algorithms, machine learning, and artificial intelligence interchangeably. And there is some overlap. But But we decided to call up a few experts to help us get a firm grasp on these concepts, starting with a basic definition of an algorithm.
An algorithm is a set of steps for solving a problem or accomplishing a goal.
That's Melanie Mitchell, Davis Professor of Complexity at Santa Fe Institute, giving the simple explanation of a computer algorithm. The next step up is machine learning, which uses algorithms, but
rather than a person programming in the rules, the system itself has learned.
For example, speech recognition software that uses data to learn which sounds combine to be words or sentences. And this kind of machine learning is a key component of artificial intelligence.
Artificial intelligence is basically capabilities of computers to mimic human cognitive functions.
Anjana Susarla teaches responsible AI at the Broad College of Business and says we should think of AI as an umbrella term.
AI is much more broader, all-encompassing compared to only machine learning or, you know, algorithms.
Which is why you might hear AI as a loose description for a range of things that show some level of intelligence, from software that examines the photos on your phone to sort out the ones with cats, to advanced spelunking robots exploring caves. Here's another way to think of the differences among these tools.
Cooking.
That's Bethany Edmonds, professor and director of computing programs at Northeastern University. She says an algorithm is basically a recipe, step-by-step instructions on how to cook something that will solve the problem of being hungry. If you took the machine learning approach, you would show a computer the ingredients you have and what you want for an end result, say, a cake.
So maybe it would take every combination of every type of food and put them all together to try and replicate the cake that was provided for it.
AI would turn the whole problem of being hungry over to the computer program, determining, maybe even buying ingredients, choosing a recipe, or creating a new one, just like a human would. So why do these distinctions matter? Well, for one thing, these tools sometimes produce results with biased outcomes, and
it's really important when we have concerns to be able to articulate what those concerns are so that you can really dissect where the problem is and how we go about solving it.
Because algorithms, machine learning, and AI are pretty much baked into our lives at this point. In the last couple of years, particularly since George Floyd was murdered, companies have been pledging more resources and attention to historically black colleges and universities, HBCUs. One of those companies, Getty Images, recently awarded $500,000 to four HBCUs to help preserve their photographic archive. WUNC's Leonita Inge has the story.
North Carolina Central University stands tall near downtown Durham. The historically black institution was founded in 1910. University archivist Andre Van says they have a lot of photographs to share with the world.
Sort of in my mind, sort of elevate up images that have been sort of hidden in plain sight. That's the best way I can call it.
Van says NCCU has attempted to digitize thousands of its most important historical photographs, but there are thousands more. He says it's not just about the picture, but the story behind the picture that counteracts a monolithic view of African Americans.
And what you see is a depth and diversity of thoughts and actions that comes out in those photographs. And you can't make that up. You can't stage that. It is just reality.
One box full of photographs, programs, and newspaper clippings highlights homecoming queens over the decades.
This is from our homecoming, where the campus queens would be in the homecoming parade, as you see there. And these are from the 90s. And then you cross-reference that with
the 60s.
There you go. There you go. This is 1964.
And I can tell this black and white photo is from the 1960s because of the hair and makeup and long white evening gloves to go with the gowns. The school also has images of visits by President Gerald Ford, First Ladies Eleanor Roosevelt, and Michelle Obama. And Van highlights a regular famous visitor to campus.
For me, one who speaks to my era and spoke to my generation is the Reverend Jesse Jackson, who has been to this institution more times, as we say in the country, than the law allows.
Van says the new partnership with Getty Images is about bringing the photos into a much more public space. NCCU will get to keep all copyrights from its photographs, and the digitized images will be placed along with the photos from other HBCUs in a special Getty collection. Half the revenue from the images will go back to the school. Some of the money will also go to a scholarship fund for HBCUs. Cassandra Illich is Vice President of Partnerships at Getty Images and Executive Director of its new HBCU Grants Program.
The wealth, the fashion sense, the beauty, the style and grace of men and women of color in the community dating back to the 1900s. I mean, that's incredible, and it's a foundation to show the strength in all of us.
Getty Images is partnering with Epson USA and AtNet Global to digitize and restore images, and the partnership includes training students to help get the hard work done. Alejandro Ibrahim is a rising senior at NCCU and a history major.
So with this photo, what we're going to do is we're going to put it in the scanner. And after we put it here, we're also going to get this tag right here, which is the metadata. And metadata is the information behind the photo, so what's going on in the photo and how we interpret it.
Prairie View A&M, Jackson State, and Claflin Universities are also included in this initial grant to set up an archival process that will take time and money. But it will guarantee that some images that might have faded away over time will now be preserved. I'm Leonita Inge for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today comes by way of a report from the New York Fed looking at how student loan borrowers are doing. Among the findings, they have much better credit scores. That pause in federal student loan payments during the pandemic helped almost 80% of borrowers achieve higher scores than they had prior to COVID-19. That's about 30 million people. Here's your moment of economic context on the way out today. By now, you've probably heard about the FBI's raid on former President Trump's home, Mar-a-Lago. Multiple reports say agents were looking for illegally retained documents. But now there's another set of documents the former president has to give up. His tax returns. A federal appeals court panel says Trump needs to turn over returns from 2015 to 2020 to the House Ways and Means Committee, although Trump is likely to appeal the decision, potentially all the way up to the Supreme Court. Our digital and on-demand team includes Carrie Barber, Dylan Mietinen, Janet Wynn, Olga Oxman, Donna Tam, and Tony Wagner. Francesca Levy is the executive director, and I'm Kimberly Adams. We'll be back tomorrow, everyone. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.